Hello everyone, this is Hugh Hendry, and I run the Eclectica hedge fund, a macro hedge fund, a rather idiosyncratic hedge fund, and I run that between the years 2002 and 2017. Spoiler alert, yes, it did come to an end. I'd like just to remind you, what is the mission here? The mission, this is an exploration of risk. This is an exploration of uncertainty. It doesn't matter that it's January 2003. Actually, we're going to be reviewing gold. Today, it seems something very similar to what was going back on then. So watching this, we can look at it now. You can examine it with hindsight. I hope that adds an element of entertainment to this exercise. But I didn't have that hindsight. I just had a sense of foreboding or a sense of change. So here we are, it's January, I've just made 4%. Stock indices, as measured by the FTSE All-Share, are down 8%. And the pressure's coming off me a little bit. I've kind of laboured the point that most hedge funds fail. And after the debacle of my, especially the first month with the hedge fund, I had been very much beset with such anxiety. But here we are, and the fund is up 0.75%, so you know, let's not open the champagne yet. But the equity indices since the launch of the fund are now down 2.5%. So kind of getting a little bit of breathing space to, you know, to find my own pace and approach with the hedge fund. Here's a question for you. Is 4% a good month? So yes. And you know, an 8% decline in FTSE All-Share tells you there's been just a big explosion at the short end of the vol curve. You know, like people have just discovered that they are on risk. And we've made money. We've profited from that. But to answer it more fully, you'd have to examine and explore the nature of risk that we had been adopting. It may be a different risk. It clearly seemed to be a different risk, given the correlations. But from the scant evidence available in this little document, the newsletter, all that can be said is that in terms of the scale of the bets we were putting on, they were large. We were 1.7 times gross long. We had shorts. Shorts were about 35%. And so the convention is to net one against the other. So that would leave us 1.35 net long. I've never been a great believer in that. If everything autocorrelated in your shorts went against you at the same time as your longs, and it happens, then we would have been in trouble. I was being a drama queen. I like to exaggerate my risk. There would have been an argument, as I see, that 28% of NAV in Eurobond futures. First of all, that is a really, really pathetically small holding in bond futures. To put that in context, we had about, what did we have? We had about just over 12 percentage points of NAV in two mid-cap gold stocks. With their volatility would have been 4 or 5x the boons. So I want to say that that position in the gold stocks would have been, just two of the gold stocks, would have been at least of equal risk weighting, if not more risky than the Eurobond futures position. We had a lot of cumulative risk. Clearly, risk was kind of pointing in different directions, and was the ideal would have been that it was, you know, we could have countered some adversity. But yeah, the quantum of risk taking was high. We made 4%. There is no gloating in this paper, and I think that's a function of, I typically would have written these things towards the end of the month, and I suspect that 3 to 4 weeks after the end of January 2003, we probably had seen quite a vicious markdown or reversal in the fortunes of those gold positions that I had in the hedge fund. I think I noticed that Chris Cole, Artemis Capital. Chris was always a great friend, and some of his insights on volatility I always found inspiring. And I think one of his recent comments was noting the right-hand side of volatility, upside volatility in gold, was beginning to look very, very similar to what we saw in the tech bubble at the end of the 1990s, which is to say these stocks would kind of, they'd go up in a Tesla manner. They got like 150%, they would then half. They would go up 150%, they would half. That kind of sawtooth, but very, very dynamic to the upside. But with these, I mean, trying to underwrite a 50% drawdown. Not easy, folks. And gold looks as if it's transforming into that kind of profile. As an example, at the end of May, I came across, hid under a rock for the best part of 2 years. But with my awakening this year, towards the end of May, I want to say I put some cash balances into gold. And I was obeying the kind of quality hierarchy of gold bullion futures. I actually also took some silver. Royalty companies, then the major gold production companies. I want to say a Newmont, and then you'd have some juniors. I'm not seeking to manage this thing actively, so that would be my universe. If I was actively managing, I'd be almost 100% in silver futures and gold mining juniors at the present time. Why? Because those mining stocks just now, the junior ones are trading on not much, not far away from 1x NEV. And I can assure you, bull markets in gold do not come to an end when those guys are trading on 1x. 3x for sure, 1x. And so the insight this month is gold. Gold, you're making me old. Why are you making me old? Because of this journey that you're insisting that I take. Why is this journey so, I was going to say erratic. It's not erratic, it's explosive. Why is it explosive? It's explosive because there's a huge element of convexity, optionality embedded into, not only is gold embedded into the mining asset, but in terms of the valuation. My goodness, it's just full of these explosions. You have gold, clearly, and then you're like an investment trust, you've got a price to NEV. And then you've got the interaction of the two. So what's kind of happening is people can... they can see gold moving. They can have expectations. Those expectations can be shaped and formed by the rate of change. That form of expectations can impact on the discounted cash flow. So the interest rate to which the analytical models would bring forward future sales of gold to the present in order to change and make calibrations to the asset value. And again, all of this, you've got then this price coming in and kind of inhaling, exhaling, which is to say creating bigger and bigger premiums and then contracting. And so variables, the rate of change in gold, the kind of normative, intellectual, macro debate in terms of the background. Remember, I was saying to you that this money that they've sought to inject, I take somewhat exceptions to the notion that they print it, but these expansions in central bank reserves that we've seen this year are very, very large. Will they help the economy? Maybe. Will they help the stock market? They have. What do they do for gold? They're just that. That's the least uncertain part of the equation. They will boost, they have, and they will continue to boost the gold price, especially if you think there's going to be more such interventions. You have this kind of macro dialogue, you've got the kind of rate of change in the price of gold, and then you've got these kind of analysts fitting and moving around with their interest rate functions, and that all then creates this kind of massive leverage coming through the price to NEV. Probably at the end of February 2003, my gold component had overshot and was probably beginning to anticipate an average gold realization price of more like something closer to $400 when the reality was $300. And so you would have had a pullback. And that's why my tone would not have been victorious. I wasn't high-fiving back then. Actually, in the beginning of the manager's report, I did want to reflect on this notion of how is one to explain our simultaneous ownership of gold shares, commodity futures. Well, that speaks for itself. But government bonds. So some of you would know that between 2005 and the ensuing crash in house prices, this nationwide, this kind of unprecedented event where we saw house prices tumble. We had been anticipating a deflationary event and had been arguing that if you think the future is inflationary, you should buy government bonds, which is to say inflation would only be unleashed by more deflationary events, which would create heroic or interventionist monetary policy responses. That's not what I mean back in January 2003. That was more a comment embedded in the observation I was seeing, let's call it torpus panique, with this kind of waterfall decline in tech stock. The majority of the German stock market lost 80% of its value in those 2 years, 2000, 2001, 3 years, 2002. And I had been overseeing a unit trust, or which is a mutual fund. And I had done everything to, I was notorious in avoiding as much as possible the ownership of equities. We had the least risky equities. We had a lot of cash. And then we used the mandate to buy government bonds. So no surprise that we'd have had these German boons. But one of the dynamics worthy of comment in the Torpus Panic, this notion of, you know, fire in the cinema, horribly graphic, people trying to rush to the exit. You'd been seeing that. I think we'd seen that in Switzerland, where the regulator had mandated a 3% return. A guaranteed return on both private and public sector pension schemes. And it was occurring just as the 10-year yields were beginning to dip below 3%. So that's your kind of exit level, if you will. If you can secure 3%, then you are kind of risk-free in terms of being the provider of these pension liabilities with this guaranteed rate. But what is to happen if you go 2.99%? Suddenly, you're going bankrupt. But you go bankrupt slower, the more that you can kind of fix your entry level yield, i.e. the more you can buy Swiss government bonds as close as possible to 3% yield. And so everyone thinking that way creates the Torpus Panic. And of course, that's what drives the yields down to 99, to 98, to 96, to 97. Where are they now? They'll be negative 70 or 80 basis points, if not more. But back then, that was the kind of rationale for owning German Bund futures at the same time as we were kind of off to the races with these gold shares. And given it's gold, given we're having this extravaganza at 16 minutes, I kind of want to rain on the party and of course just point out that as businesses, gold shares kind of suck. If you look at Newmont, again, the gilded Newmont that can do no wrong, well, the 10 years from 2002 to 2012, you know, the gold price had gone 310 to almost 1700. Their EBIT margins had exploded. But cash costs, it was getting, you know, so darn expensive to get those last ounces of gold out of the ground. They got, they more than doubled from $190 per ounce to something more like $700 an ounce. They still had operational leverage. I mean, clearly the profit margins were reflecting that. But, you know, net cash gone from $5 billion to net debt. They'd had to issue shares, so you, as an equity holder, you'd been diluted. And then gold production was down a third as well. So you own a third less unless you kept up with your rights, and you're producing a third less gold. And that's in the best of times. And the other thing I must add is that kind of there's a volatility illusion. The gold shares typically are kind of vibrating, if you will, 2 to 3 times more than the gold futures. And so to compare how well the gold shares have performed, you should really make a comparison with what your return would have been if you'd had 2 or 3 times more in the gold futures. So if you had 10%, what would have been your return if you had 30% in gold futures versus, let's say, a 10% position in gold mining equity? Normally you find that that tends to take away, and there's no great rationale for taking on the very specific risks that you can find within some of these gold money stock. I mentioned royalty companies. Franco-Nevada comes to mind. Yes, that's, is it an oxymoron? They're like a kind of a smart venture capitalist. This mastermind special subject is where is the gold? And they buy a percentage of production. They don't pick up any liability associated with the cost. So as the gold price goes up, typically you find the cost of extraction goes up. It gets more expensive to get it out of the ground. But that's no problem for them. You know, when the gold price goes up, their partners, they very definitely want to get the gold out of the ground. And it's them who take on the extravagant cost of doing so. They just sit there and they collect the royalty check. Good luck if you're trying to do a valuation model. Been there, tried, hard. I can ultimately just have trust in the matrix of the If you're really risk hungry, you go for the juniors just now, especially because the valuation is rather compelling, the one times metric. And then if you're trying to lay off risk, you go into the larger cap stocks. If you're trying to lay off more risk, you're beginning to get worried that if gold really had its big run, then you should be in the royalty stocks. Or you have, like me, you have a kind of staging post in each and weights which can change over the course of the rather extravagant rise that we can see in gold that I saw and that I witnessed in the year of 2003 and onwards, which we're probably experiencing in the here and now in 2020 with our perfect vision. David Yarrow was a hedge fund manager, a British hedge fund manager from Glasgow, like me. David came from a very different part of Glasgow, company, the family company, the eponymous Yarrow Shipyards. A big deal, very socially connected, but very entertaining nevertheless. I'd met David at various speaking engagements, and he always had that wow factor, and he always made me laugh. What comes to mind is I recall having to attend one of these best, or what is your best trade? Tell me your best idea. And David spoke before me, and he was such, like I say, very entertaining, but such a sucker for kind of brown nosing is not the right term, but you know, name dropping seems to be the best way of describing it. And so he stood up before me, and I said, this will be interesting. And David's like, well, you know, one of our big investors, external investors in our hedge fund. His hedge fund was called Pegasus. And performed well. But shame on him at the end of 1999. He was, and again, it was his ardour for making these name connections. He was like Carphone Warehouse, which was one of their biggest UK retailer of mobile phone contracts. I never understood why they should capture a lot of economic value in that transaction. To my mind, they were like the butler offering, you know, the phone on a silver platter. Regardless, he was like, so, you know, I've got the biggest seller of these phone contracts in the UK. They're my fund. They give me all of this intel. And not only that, but I've just spent the weekend in an igloo with the chief executive of Nokia. And, you know, from our vision inside, looking at the Northern Lights, the future just seemed so bright. Not only was the present with its 30% market share, two times, I think, bigger than its nearest competitor, big fat profit margins and everyone loving its phones. Not only was the present so amazing, but the future was going to be even brighter. And so I think it was just the name dropping that annoyed me. So, and I had to go next. And so I said, well, you know, we share something in common, not our take on the future, but we have some common shareholders, common investors. And so, yeah, we have the same guys, but I've not been invited. Thank heavens I've not been invited to an igloo. I keep myself to myself. I don't think I had any particular rage against Nokia. I'm not going to give you a fundamentals argument for why Nokia peaked at the end of 1999. I think fundamentals are redundant in the kind of exponential terminal stage of those bubbles. My point was we were experiencing a bubble, and sooner rather than later it would come crashing down. That ended up being correct, but I mean, who cares? The point of this story is I got back into the office and someone had ratted on me. Carphone Warehouse are on the phone. They're like, how dare you say such bad things about us? And Crispin, to his credit, Crispin Odey was many things. But at times like this, he was just such a great boss. And he made light of the matter. And of course, I had to fawn and I had to apologize. But I remember beginning the conversation by saying, can I just say, I'm really, 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 really sorry. No, I'm sorry, 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 sorry. I should never have said that. But I bought some Nokia. I'm way too early in buying Nokia. You know, I needed Durban Deep to triple before I bought it at 10 to see a trade, you know, 60% higher in the month of June. And it's for the worst of reasons, because I just can't get away from, it's had its bear market and it's profoundly volatile. At the bottom of a range, which can be enough to bankrupt you if you get your positioning wrong, But it's that fifth generation infrastructure spend. Business kind of looks as if it can survive on its own as it is, but the optionality that would come from, I guess, this politically ordained demise of Huawei. There's some other Asian competitors, but I understand they're kind of useless. If the US is waging this war, it's very odd that it doesn't have a national champion. And just, I can't get away from the fact that embedded within Nokia is Alcatel-Lucent. So Lucent had been a big the US telecom infrastructure play. It had been taken out by Alcatel, and then it was subsequently taken out by Nokia. And why doesn't Cisco, one of those kind of names, come in and take it, extract it out of Nokia? And then have a national champion for the US to rally around and ensure that it's installed. Why not? Don't know, question mark. But I took a gamble. I would not recommend it as a gamble to you, but having spoken about Nokia back then, as I say, it's been recurring. And then finally, David's been recurring because I took a month out of the office and I spent it in Moustique, very much the VIP island. Eclectic by name and by nature, possibly cheap by nature, managed to secure a good deal on the cheapest house on the island. But it didn't have AC, but it did have these beautiful wooden shutters, and you would open them, and the island breeze would cool you down. Except there was no island breeze for the month of November. And my son broke his ankle. He was 4 years old, and the medication made him grumpy. And my mother-in-law was there. It was not a great time. Such not a great time that we were offered to buy the property at the end for about $1.5 million. I was like, neighbors with Mick Jagger, that sounds kind of rock star-ish. But it was such a hideous time. My wife said, we're never coming back. And anyway, on the way back, as I made my way back after a month, the month that had seen the kind of the election play out, the very close election between Bush and Gore and the drama in Florida. On the way back, I was connecting via Barbados, and who do I see but David Yarrow? And he's in the business class and looking resplendently wonderful, and I look like something the cat drags in. And so I put my hat down, and I kind of sped past him to my cheap economy seats. But sitting there, I was like, you know what? I am definitely going to start my own asset management business. And so I thank David. I thank David for just pushing me to break the status quo. It's very hard to break away from an existing and a super different, super energized partnership, which was Odie. But to see David in the expensive business class seats from on the trip from Barbados back to London was what I needed. And what I need and what you need is now for me to sign off. I promise you these are going to become more regular. And yes, the Eclectica Monthly for January 2003 is at an end. It was a good month. The boy's coming back. We are now modestly up since inception. Let's tune in soon, find out what happens in February. I think we already know times get tough again. But anyway, thank you very much, guys. Thank you. Bye.